Ramon Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. Me, Martinez. The Getty Fire along the 405 freeway has burned more than 600 acres and forced thousands to evacuate. According to the LA Fire Department, at least 8 homes are destroyed. We'll hear where things stand live from the area. Plus, we'll also hear from Governor Gavin Newsom on how California is dealing with the more than a dozen fires burning in the state right now. That and a lot more coming up when Take 2 kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us on another day with wildfires grabbing headlines throughout the state. In about 20 minutes, we're going to speak with Governor Gavin Newsom about how his administration is responding to the many blazes that are burning. But right now, we're going to check in on the Getty Fire here in Los Angeles. It started early this morning, right around 1:30, sending many residents fleeing their homes in the dark. Here are a few of those stories.
The police brought me here this morning. They were going door to door, and so I grabbed the dog, and I grabbed my address book, and that's it.
We're in a six-mile-long cul-de-sac, and if a fire is in our path before we could get to Sunset Boulevard, we would be trapped.
We have insurance, and we got out all of our, you know, our pet and ourselves and anything kind of sentimental. We've been packed since last Monday because the Palisades fire was, that evacuation was a block the other direction. So the car's been packed for the last week. So we just, we're ready to go in about 5 minutes.
Those are the voices of Mandy Favaloro, Jerry Abdominian, and Ingrid Curtis. So far, the Getty Fire has burned a little more than 600 acres. 8 homes have been destroyed, 5 damaged. KPCC Sharon McNary has been out there all day at the command center. Sharon, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Sharon? What are the conditions there right now?
Well, you know, the Santa Ana winds that we kept hearing about overnight, they peaked this morning, and then there was a little dead zone, but now the wind has actually shifted. So what we're getting now is an onshore wind that's a cooler wind. It's actually putting a lot of the ash from the fire onto us here. We're on the VA campus near UCLA, and so there's ash falling on us, but that's going to change. And it, as we just heard earlier, it's going to bring some Santa Ana winds tomorrow, peaking on Wednesday with winds up to 70 miles an hour in the windiest areas. So it's okay right now, but it's going to change and change for the more difficult to deal with it in the fire area.
Yeah, that is what everyone around here is dreading. How's the firefight going, though, right now? There are a lot of homes that where that fire has burned. It seems like a lot of damage has been kept at a minimum, 8 homes destroyed. What tools do firefighters have right now at their disposal?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to hear them talk about how they can send a lot of firefighters to kind of pinch the fire at the margins and protect homes, but then they have helicopters dropping water and planes dropping fire retardant out at the head of the fire, you know, where it's most dangerous. And so that's just one of the tools. You know, the recession's over. They've been able to staff up and increase their equipment. But they're also using some fairly new tools. They've got drones that they can send up that can check for hot spots in the fire area. They've also got airplanes that do some pretty advanced imagery and that use software. They take all that data, they put it into software that actually helps them predict where the fire is going to go. And they say it's pretty accurate and it's pretty fast. And that's one thing that allows them to send firefighters to the right place where they're going to be most useful.
Talk to KPCC's Cher McNary about the fire that's going on near the Getty Center. Now, when it comes to the firefighters themselves, we mentioned all the equipment that they're using, the technology. How are they holding up? Because, I mean, for a lot of these men and women, I mean, this has got to be the fifth fire in about 2 weeks. They have got to be just tired as can be.
And dirty. I saw a crew of about 20 firefighters come in. And while I'm sure they've been able to get showers and cleaned up personally between fires, this crew of Del Rosa Hotshots, just to give you an example, they're based in San Bernardino. They were fighting the old Waterman fire in San Bernardino. And just as that was dying down, they got sent to the Tick Fire in the San Fernando Valley. And as that was going into mop-up stage, then they get sent to this fire. And I mean, I had to pull my fire pants out of the laundry for the second time this week.
Wow.
They haven't had a chance to clean up their, you know, the Nomex, the yellow jackets that they wear that are fire resistant. So they were just covered in soot. And, you know, it's just they're exhausted. I could just see it in their faces.
Yeah, if you ever see a firefighter, I always try, if I ever see one, just to say thanks. Just in general, a general thanks to any California firefighter. What can you tell us about the terrain of the area that's been burned this morning? Because it's one that really hasn't burned in a long time, the 1970s we're hearing.
For Mandeville Canyon, yes, that is the case. So let's start with, okay, imagine the 405 as it goes through Sepulveda Pass between the San Fernando Valley and the LA Basin. There are canyons that parallel the 405 freeway, and each of those areas has houses built up on the ridges. And, you know, being in a house at the top of a ridge is like one of the most dangerous places you can be fire-wise. Mandeville Canyon has not burned since October 1978, and at that time it burned 38,000 acres. In fact, I can remember anchoring that fire at my college radio station, KCSN, that year. The fire burned all the way to the ocean. If the conditions are as bad as what we're seeing possibly tomorrow, I mean, we can't just take this lull for granted. It's going to be a very dangerous situation for a little while to come.
Are you getting the sense, Sharon, that you mentioned it's a lull, that they want to try and do as much as they can now before that inevitable wind that's slated for the next couple of days?
Absolutely. And one of the big things that they're doing is imagine how wide the 405 freeway is.
Yeah.
And then imagine you're going to cut a fire break at the top of Topanga Canyon with bulldozers that is as wide as how many lanes of the 405, 8, 10, 12 lanes?
Yeah.
That's what they're going to do to keep the fire from going into Topanga Canyon.
Sharon, you mentioned a lot of homes up there. Embers can be blown a long way. What can you tell people in the area about what maybe last-minute things they can do to protect their homes, if they can?
Yeah, turn off your air conditioning, close your garage, move things that are flammable inside your house away from your windows, because a fire that's heating up your windows can actually be hot enough to not melt the glass, but catch stuff inside the house on fire. There's a 5-foot rule now that the legislature passed. It says get everything that's burnable around your house if you live in a high fire area at least 5 feet away from your house. And, you know, maybe don't put your deck in made of wood or your garden gate made of wood. Those are all things that can help. They call them ladders. It can help the fire make its way to your house. And so you want to have a zone around your house that is free of things that are going to catch on fire. Your Halloween decorations, your little wooden bench, all that stuff can catch on fire. And then there goes your house.
That's one of the things, Sharon, we've learned over the last few years, right? Is that we just can't rely on the firefighters. We have to be our own fire prevention people in a way.
Absolutely. And anything you can do to keep the embers from going into your attic, like, you know, the vents in your roof, if they're pulling air in for air conditioning, you don't want them to pull in embers. I know some people who are in the Topanga Fire Safe Council, and they have worked really, really hard to get all the people there to use, like, very tiny screening
around
all the house vents and change the roofs and all that.
That's KPCC's Sharon McNary out at the Command Center for the Getty Fire. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Coming up in about 6 minutes, we are going to talk to Governor Gavin Newsom. But to politics now, Southern California Congresswoman Katie Hill announced yesterday she is resigning. In a video posted to YouTube, she blamed attacks by her estranged husband and what she called right-wing media for forcing her to step down. These attacks included intimate photos published online without her consent.
Too many Americans are counting on Washington to fulfill our promises of quality health care, housing we can afford, and a government that works for the people. And I cannot let this horrible smear campaign get in the way of that work.
Hill was also the subject of an ethics investigation over allegations of an improper relationship with a congressional staff member, a charge she has denied. It's a dramatic turn of events for a woman who was a fast-rising star in the Democratic Party. Hill was elected last November to represent the 25th Congressional District, which includes Santa Clarita, Lancaster, and Palmdale. KPCC senior politics reporter Libby Denkman joins us now to talk about what happened. Hey, Libby.
Hi, A.
All right. The announcement seemed to come very suddenly. So what ultimately led to Hill's departure?
It's not totally clear yet. All last week, Hill was fending off conservative news stories and photos accusing her of improper relationships with staff. The House Ethics Committee did open an investigation, and then Hill admitted on Wednesday she had dated a member of her campaign staff. She said that was a lapse in judgment, and she admitted it was inappropriate. She said it happened because she's going through a very tough divorce. There are new House rules against relationships with subordinates, but campaign staff aren't explicitly covered in that. And as you said, Hill has strongly denied having an affair with her congressional staffer.
Okay, so then why resign?
Again, we have to read between the lines here. These photos and the text messages of intimate conversations just kept coming. Hill's supporters say many of the photos could possibly be considered revenge porn under California and D.C. law. I think ultimately Hill was facing this consistent barrage of innuendo and allegations, having to spend time defending against them, and the release of these very personal photos and text messages created a situation where she felt she was always looking over her shoulder. And of course, this also raises the concern that she would be vulnerable to blackmail. Then there's the collateral damage to her staff and supporters, and people named in these stories that she had to consider. They're getting dragged into a lot of nasty stuff online. She said she's stepping down for the good of her constituents and the country.
Now, Democrats have been relatively quiet, but what's your sense about how much House leadership got involved here? Maybe other Democrats?
Nancy Pelosi released a statement praising Hill's commitment to her community and vision. But she said there were, quote, errors in judgment by Hill, and those errors, quote, made her continued service as a member untenable. Pelosi continued saying, we must ensure a climate of integrity and dignity in the Congress and in all workplaces. So there could have been some pressure from Democratic House leadership to have a no-tolerance policy for members having any kind of relationship with subordinates. This is in the wake of Me Too and changing the House rules to make this activity, which could really constitute an abuse of power, a boss and an employee, to make that off limits.
All right, so what are supporters saying?
Many of them in the 25th District are just devastated by this whole situation. I spoke to Risa Barrios, a Democratic activist. She said she lives in Adelanto, but she drove over to Santa Clarita and Palmdale on weekends during the 2018 campaign just to knock on doors and help elect Hill. She's deeply disappointed that Katie Hill decided to resign after so many volunteers worked so hard to get her into office. Barrios acknowledges there are ethical concerns with Hill's former relationship with a campaign staffer. That relationship, the imbalance of power, everything we've been talking about today, it could be disqualifying, according to Barrios. But she says that lapse in judgment has really overshadowed the online harassment Hill and the campaign staffer are facing.
It's such an abuse tactic, and it's awful that media outlets even bought into it, because the thing is that it is a sex crime. Revenge porn is a sex crime, bottom line. Those were released to cause her harm, and it is outright abusive.
And she says there are also elements of possible biphobia and polyphobia in some of the salacious headlines that we saw in media coverage of this relationship. Hill is one of the first openly bisexual members of Congress, and the campaign staffer she dated is a woman. I reached out to the Stonewall Democratic Club of LA, which is a progressive LGBTQ group, and they argued Hill was the victim of a double standard because she is female and bi. They said many male politicians and straight male politicians have gotten away with affairs with staffers, and they've remained in office.
All right, so she's leaving Congress, but Katie Hill has said this isn't over yet, right? It sounds like she's going to keep fighting this in court potentially.
Yeah, and she's going after it both legally and at this point in the court of public opinion. Hill said she's going to shift her focus after Congress to combating online harassment.
I will fight to ensure that no one else has to live through what I just experienced. Some people call this electronic assault, digital exploitation. Others call it revenge porn. As the victim of it, I call it one of the worst things that we can do to our sisters and our daughters.
I want to point out, A, that I tried very hard to reach Kenny Helsup, who is Katie Hill's estranged husband. She's making very serious accusations of abuse against him in statements and in this video that she released today. And we wanted to hear from him or his lawyer to respond to them. I was not able to reach them, but I will keep trying.
All right. So what's next then? What happens to the 25th district? That's Santa Clarita, Palmdale, Lancaster, the Antelope Valley. That's her district.
Yeah. Well, under California law, Governor Gavin Newsom has 14 days to call a special election to fill the seat once there is a resignation. We don't know yet when that election will be held exactly, but many observers are banking Newsom will probably schedule the vote to coincide with the March 3rd presidential primary, both to save money and strategically it would be good for a Democratic governor to ensure a strong Democratic turnout. And this leaves a wide open hole in this race. Katie Hill has huge name recognition, a national profile, and she already raised over $1.5 million for cash on hand for her reelection. Today, Assemblywoman Christy Smith, whose district overlaps with a good portion of the 25th Congressional District, announced she is running. She released a video announcing that campaign. And there are other big Democratic names floating around as well. And that, I have to say, is to be continued because we haven't heard an official announcement from those yet.
Sure. Now, I know her district was considered a purple district. What are we hearing from Republicans?
Well, a familiar face is back. Former Representative Steve Knight, whom Katie Hill beat last year to flip the seat, he waited just a couple hours after her resignation announcement yesterday to go on Facebook and say he's looking to get in. He says a lot of people have been asking him to return to Congress, and he's listened, and now he's back.
All right, that's KPCC senior politics reporter Libby Denkman. Libby, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, coming up, we're still expecting to hear from California Governor Gavin Newsom. That's coming up in just a bit. But sticking with politics, when Take Two continues, another political battle shaping up right here in Los Angeles in the form of the district attorney's race. We'll have more on that when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. As expected, former San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon announced today that he's running for the same job in Los Angeles. His effort to unseat incumbent DA Jackie Lacey will likely draw national attention. It marks the biggest showdown to date in the battle to define the future of criminal justice reform in the U.S. KPCC's Frank Stoltz has this profile of Gascon.
The first thing you should know about George Gascon is that he's from Havana, Cuba. He once described how his uncle was in prison for 10 years for being a union organizer and how his father lost his job for speaking out against Fidel Castro.
After years of harassment by the government, my family immigrated to Los Angeles as political refugees when I was 13.
That was in 1967. After dropping out of Bell High School, he joined the Army. Then, in 1978, the LAPD.
I was a warrior, right? I view myself as a police officer in that thin blue line that I had to go out there and make as many arrests as I could.
Over time, his outlook changed. Father Greg Boyle, who's worked for decades to get young men out of gangs, stands outside Dolores Mission in a Boyle Heights neighborhood Gascon once patrolled.
You know, Cubanos are not really typical here in Los Angeles.
Boyle says that often made Gascon, whom he calls a friend, an outsider, even among Latinos. As a result, Gascon had what Boyle calls more reverence than most cops.
Reverence for the complexity of things. You know, he didn't presume to know stuff. And consequently, he's an open guy.
3 years after joining the LAPD, Gascon left to sell cars at a Ford dealership, where he became sales manager. He remained a reserve officer during that time and rejoined the force full-time in 1986, a time when the LAPD faced allegations of systemic racism and brutality. 6 years later, the city erupted in riots after a jury acquitted the officers who beat Rodney King.
utter anarchy in the streets of Los Angeles tonight. It's just getting worse.
Gascon rejected the paramilitary arrest-heavy approach to policing poor and minority neighborhoods. Over two decades, he rose through the ranks to become an assistant chief at a time of reform, earning a law degree along the way. When Gascon was passed over for chief in 2006, he left to lead the police department in Mesa, Arizona, where he refused to work with then-Sheriff Joe Arpaio to deport people. At one point, Gascon and Arpaio clashed after the sheriff sent his deputies on a midnight raid of Mesa City Hall in search of unauthorized immigrants.
It's certainly concerning. We would prefer that we didn't have to play this kind of games, that everybody would come together, work together.
Bottom line, he's doing everything to keep me from going into that city, locking up illegals.
3 years later, in 2009, Gascon was back in California.
Ladies and gentlemen, the next chief of police in the city and county of San Francisco, Chief George Gascon.
Within 18 months, Gascon convinced then-Mayor Gavin Newsom to appoint him district attorney to replace Kamala Harris, who had been elected state attorney general. With his new platform, the one-time LAPD warrior became one of the state's loudest critics of the war on drugs.
It is unconscionable. It is immoral. It is unethical.
On this stretch of Los Angeles Street downtown, a dirt lot is all that remains of the LAPD's old headquarters, Parker Center, which met the wrecking ball earlier this year. I meet up with Steve Gordon, who sits on the board of the union that represents rank-and-file officers. When you guys heard George Gascon was going to run for DA, what was your reaction?
That really concerned us.
Gordon is bald, but you can still see the hair stand up on the back of his neck when he considers Gascon's return to L.A.
You know, if you're going to leave, leave. Don't come back with a different agenda.
For a lot of old-school cops, Gascon is a turncoat, more interested in coddling criminals than catching them. Gordon says, look at what Gascon did to San Francisco.
You know, with the feces all over the street, the needles all over the street, the open-air drug markets.
That description is over the top. The city did experience an epidemic of car break-ins during Gascon's tenure, but it's unfair to blame the DA for everything, says UC Berkeley criminologist Frank Zimmerman.
It might be easier to blame failures in policing.
For his part, the 65-year-old Gascon touts his effort to keep nonviolent offenders out of jail. He also took on the police. Gascon assembled a blue ribbon panel to examine racial bias in the San Francisco PD. And he opposed a ballot measure backed by the police union that would have allowed more liberal use of tasers. Zimmerman says in the end what stands out most about Gascon is that he is a cop who became a DA and outspoken critic of the nation's justice system.
George Gascon was a remarkable outlier as a prosecutor.
Gascon dares to suggest DAs listen not just to crime victims, but to perpetrators who need help changing their lives.
I would say that we have to hack our justice system. And the first hack is that we have to turn our core system upside down.
5 years ago, Gascon burnished his credentials as a reformer when he co-authored Proposition 47, which lowered certain drug and theft felonies to misdemeanors. 2 years later, he backed Prop 64, which legalized marijuana, and another measure that would have abolished the death penalty. Incumbent LADA Jackie Lacey opposed Props 47 and 64 and has continued to seek the death penalty even after the governor declared a moratorium on it. A few weeks ago, L.A.'s League of Women Voters hosted an event entitled What is the DA's Role in the Transformation of the Justice System? It's huge, said Miriam Krinsky, who heads a reform group called Fair and Just Prosecution.
They're the gatekeeper that decides whether somebody is going to come into the system, what kind of charges, if any, they'll be facing, or whether a young person will be charged as an adult, whether a death penalty will result.
Historically, reformers focused on police, but prosecutors have more power and influence, says Krinsky.
DAs define our community's moral compass around the criminal justice system.
Over the past 3 years, the political landscape for DAs has shifted, with Philadelphia and Chicago electing reformist prosecutors promising to lock up fewer people. Now, LA County, home to the largest DA's office in the nation, is the next battleground, says Cal State LA political scientist Rafe Sonnenschein.
LA has always been seen as the great prize.
Miriam Krinsky agrees.
There are a lot of eyes of the nation on this race.
The LA DA's office sends a lot of people to state prison, more than 600 per 100,000 residents in 2017, according to the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. That's more than four times the incarceration rate of San Francisco. Jackie Lacey ran unopposed 4 years ago. This time around, she faces challenges from Gascon and two of her deputies. And, says Sun and Shine, a debate far different from the days when it was enough for a prosecutor to say they were tough on crime.
In the old days, the concern about crime would way outweigh the call for reform. Now I think it's actually even money.
The primary is March 3rd. Covering public safety, I'm Frank Stoltz.
All right, switching gears, we are still, though, keeping an eye and ear on the Getty fire. But if you're flying into LAX and hoping to catch a taxi or maybe an Uber or Lyft, those sorts of curbside pickups will no longer be allowed starting 3 a.m. tomorrow. Instead, travelers who want to leave the airport using a ride hail or cab will need to go to a new terminal called LA Exit. The terminal can be reached with a new shuttle service or simply by walking. Laura Jane Nelson has been writing about this for the LA Times. She joins us now to explain exactly how the new system will work. Laura, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, the new pickup area, LA Exit, just east of Terminal 1. Tell us what will change for passengers with curbside ride hails and taxis.
It's going to change quite a bit. For starters, you're not going to be able to call an Uber or a Lyft or get into a taxi at the curb, obviously. Instead, in order to get to this new pickup area, which the airport is calling LA Exit, you'll need to either walk or get on one of the bright green shuttle buses that's going to be circulating on the arrivals level.
All right. Now, to be clear, only pickups are changing. Curbside drop-offs with an Uber and Lyft or a taxi are still going to be allowed, right? Right there at the terminal.
That's correct. Drop-offs will be exactly the same as they've been since Uber and Lyft started operating at the airport.
I wonder if I'd be allowed to just slide into an Uber right there. I don't want to get in trouble, right?
I'm sure people will try it, but you know, technically the drivers aren't allowed to pick people up like that. They have to get the approval through the app and you know, all those details.
Now, travelers can either walk or take a shuttle to LA Exit. How often is the shuttle supposed to run, and where will people be able to catch it?
So the shuttle will run every 3 to 5 minutes, so pretty frequently. And the curbside lanes that are closest to the terminal on the arrivals level, the area where you used to be able to have your friends and family come and pick you up, are going to be converted into bus-only lanes. So the shuttles will, in theory, be operating at a pretty fast clip because there won't be a lot of traffic to impede them. So when you leave the terminal, you will either see a shuttle stop right in front of the terminal, which is the case for the terminals that are the furthest away from the pickup lot. So like Terminal 3, Tom Bradley, Terminal 4, Terminal 5, the stop will be right outside. For Terminals 1 and 2, the stop is between those two terminals. It's shared. And that's because the walk from those two terminals is like really quick. So they're assuming that a lot of people will just be able to kind of hoof it.
Right away, yeah.
Yeah.
Talking to Laura J. Nelson, staff writer with the LA Times. Now, with the new system, when exactly should travelers request the Uber or the Lyft? When they get off the plane or once they start walking or once they get to the pickup terminal, people are going to try and time it best way they can, Laura.
Right. I think that, you know, the first couple of weeks, I'm assuming there's going to be some kind of early hiccups, but the airport is saying that you should open the Uber and Lyft app and start the process of booking your ride once you've landed and stepped off the plane into the terminal. So you don't need to wait until you get out to the curbside. You don't need to wait until you get all the way to the lot. You should start the process once you get off the plane, deplane into the terminal area. And they are saying that Uber and Lyft will have instructions in the app and a kind of a general sense of how long that process will take. Now, it's possible that won't go smoothly.
It doesn't sound like it will, Laura. I've got to be honest.
Right. And then for taxis, if you take a cab, you can just get right on the shuttle or you can walk right over to the pickup area and there's a taxi stand there and you'll just be able to slide into the first available car.
Now, with this new pickup system, you crunch the numbers to figure out how long it'll take to get from each terminal to the new pickup area. So let's start with the shuttle. It looks like the trip will take longest if you hop on the shuttle at Terminal 1, even though technically, geographically, it's the closest.
Right. So the traffic, you know, the big horseshoe at LAX,
yeah.
The traffic circulates in a counterclockwise direction, right? So you go from Terminal 1 to Terminal 2 to Terminal 3. So the shuttle follows that same pattern. The traffic is one way. So it stands to reason that the shuttle time is longest from Terminal 1 because it has to go all the way through the loop before it can get back to the pickup area. The good news there is that it's a 3-minute walk. So you don't necessarily have to go through the wait time and the boarding and the riding if you're physically able to, like, basically hop right across the street.
Now, one more thing, Laura, real quick. How is this new system expected to affect overall travel times? Will it take longer than the current curbside pickup system?
So I think it depends on when you are doing the current pickup system now. I mean, as you probably know, during really busy times, the pickup system at LAX these days can be like a real mess. I've waited almost an hour before on like kind of peak travel weekends and peak holidays. The airport is saying that under the new system, you should reliably be out of the airport basically within half an hour of starting the process.
Wow. Okay. Well,
that's what they're saying.
We'll have to hold them to that. Laura J. Nelson, staff writer with the LA Times. Laura, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
There are over a dozen fires burning right now in California. PG&E has shut off power to millions up north to try and not spark any new ones, but that can create other issues as well. Governor Gavin Newsom has had some strong words for Pacific Gas and Electric. We're going to hear from him next on what Californians can expect both in the short and long term when it comes to our 24/7, 365 fire season. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. We've been covering the Getty Fire burning in West LA at around 600 acres. 8 homes have been destroyed so far. Many residents remain evacuated from their homes. And up in Northern California, the Kincaid Fire is still burning in its fourth day. 66,000 acres burned. Over the weekend, Governor Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency. Governor joins us now. Welcome to Take 2, Governor.
Good to be with you.
First off, firefighters, how are they doing battling the Kincaid Fire? How are things looking up there?
Well, we've got over 4,100 firefighters working on it. Every conceivable piece of equipment we can find, not only from within the state, be it DC-10s and the 747 and other helicopters, but we've been able to bring in 75 engines from Oregon and additional 75 from other states all across the West to come in and help battle the fire.
Considering how many fires are burning right now throughout the state, Governor, how do you decide how to deploy them and where to deploy them to? I know LAFD and Costa Mesa are at Kincaid, but now we've got all this fire here in the LA area.
Well, to put it in perspective, literally 330 fires over the last 24 hours that the state was responsible for suppressing and was successful at doing so. We had a few dozen up here in Northern California in the last 24 hours that got some attention, but most don't because of pre-positioned assets, which are at historic levels. And it's interesting and probably counterintuitive to anybody who's listening that this has been a below average fire season to date. And at this moment, despite all of the legitimate consternation and stress associated, particularly with the Getty and Kincaid fires, we're only slightly on the higher end of average for this time of year.
That's actually kind of incredible to think that it's been a below average fire season. I guess when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't definitely feel that way. What would be the biggest short-term need right now?
Biggest short-term need is just patience and vigilance and just continuing tenacity for these firefighters. Again, not just Cal Fire, but all our mutual aid supporters, local firefighters, and then our federal partners. And these guys have just been battling this nonstop, and they've done a remarkable job up in Northern California, just surrounding the town of Healdsburg and Windsor, keeping it from one side of the freeway. And in fact, just a few moments ago, we got some very good news that we're going to start repopulating some of the 180,000+ people that have been evacuated. And even at the Getty, the word's coming back that despite a lot of the legitimate stress down there with the air support and the remarkable job that LA has done, that we feel like we've got our hands around that as well.
Talking to California Governor Gavin Newsom about our federal partners, Governor, what kind of help are we getting from D.C. right now?
Well, I got to say, I mean, you know, anybody who's paid any attention to the California versus Trump back and forth, this is maybe surprising, but every single thing we've asked for from the Trump administration, they provided. We have had what we call three FMAGs, which is this federal assistance grant requests that have been advanced in immediate and real time. So I couldn't be more thankful and more pleased by their response. No, I can assure you, no politics has been played, and that's exactly what one should expect. But I've got to say, we're very grateful for that.
So the lines of communication are definitely open there. That's encouraging.
Very encouraging. And I got to say this, you know, I've been in office only 9 months, but from day one, Trump administration has not played politics on any of the emergency declarations, either be the earthquakes we've had or the fires we had coming into the last season, debris removal, et cetera. So, you know, it's just one area where I think the public should know there's a good working partnership despite the sparring that goes back and forth on so many other issues.
Yeah. You've recently passed laws to encourage home hardening. Do you have plans for the state to subsidize those retrofits?
Yeah, it's the magnitude of the requirement of the subsidies that we've got to figure out. But there's no substitute for individuals looking at this defensible spaces, cleaning up their backyards, addressing some of their issues as it relates to when their construction was done and what kind of materials are on their roof or their vents or on their decks. And to the extent people aren't fixed income or struggling, as so many are, we want to provide some grants and loans. And we've been working with a lot of local government, and obviously the state needs to help out. And we're looking at next year's budget to see that we can substantially expand those proposals.
When it comes to new homes, built maybe in the future, will they be built with specifications to defend against wildfires? Because we always hear from fire ecologists, Governor, that it's better to build homes safely to begin with rather than retrofit.
It's remarkable when you just consider the magnitude of the destruction almost a year ago next week up at the Camp Fire. Of course, we had the Woolsey Fire in Southern California, the Camp Fire that took 85 lives up in Butte County. The structures that survived, in fact, over half the structures that did survive were constructed with all of our modern rules. The overwhelming majority of those structures were built pre-Title 24, and those old rules had burned down. So you're exactly right that building material construction methods are really the most significant thing we could do to defend against property loss. That said, we have the world's, arguably, with our earthquakes and with our fires, some of the best and most constructive protocols already in place. So new construction, major remodels will trigger these new materials. But again, the vast majority of our stock is older stock, and people are not necessarily availing themselves because of the costs associated. And that's where we have to step in.
Speaking of new construction, how about preventing new construction in high fire danger zones? How is that a possibility going forward?
Yeah, we put out a report in March that laid out detail that we want all local land use planners, and when they're updating their master plans, their quote-unquote what we call general plans, to consider fire safety, which has not been done in the past. But let me just make this point. There are 4.5 million homes already built in what we call this WUI, which is the Wildland Urban Interface. 11 million Californians live in that already built stock. So it's one thing talking about the future, but we really have to recognize that there's vulnerability already in place for 11 million Californians, and we've got to be more aggressive in the vegetation management, defensible spaces, and evacuation in and around those built communities.
Would you incentivize those 11 million people to relocate their homes outside of these areas?
I think that's honestly just, imagine relocating a quarter of the population.
Well, I'm not saying it would be easy, Governor, but I'm just saying at this point we try a lot of different things.
I think we can do more to protect these communities. Look, 57% of the forests in the state are federally managed, and they've been cutting their forest budget. We have been substantially increasing our efforts on evacuation. I focused a lot on vegetation management, forest management, evacuation in this year's budget. We put almost $1 billion in this space, more than we ever have in our past. And we also did emergency projects focusing on 200 vulnerable communities. I want to continue that process, then, rather than going to a family whose grand parents built a home 100 years ago and saying you got to tear that home down and relocate to another part of the state. I just don't think, honestly, that's realistic. Land use going forward is realistic, but going after 11 million Californians and saying your property no longer has value and we're going to restrict your fate and future and your resale, that's a difficult task, and I don't think that's going to be realistic.
I'm talking to California Governor Gavin Newsom. One of the things that I keep hearing all over the place, it doesn't matter where, when people look up and see the fires on television, they say, well, that's just the way it is now. That is just the way it is. What do you say to someone that says that, that thinks that, Governor?
Well, I mean, there is some truth to that. I mean, you know, you can go back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. There's not been a governor that's been spared on these fires. We've had 10 of the most destructive wildfire seasons since 2015, the worst in 2017, 18, and 2015. But as I said, we've actually had a handle around it this year under very difficult circumstances, coming out of a five-year drought and one of the wettest years, which has its own set of challenges. I'm not willing to give up. I'm not willing to accept quote-unquote new normal. I'm not naive about climate change. I'm not naive about the hot's getting hotter and the dry's getting drier. But I am also insistent that our investor-owned utilities look at a 21st century modern delivery system. And I think that's the great opportunity this state faces. And that is a true Green New Deal that focuses on reimagining the grid,
Governor,
so we mitigate this damage.
Two more things really quick while I have you. To the blackouts going on with PG&E, you expressed interest in having Warren Buffett's company, Berkshire Hathaway, take over PG&E. Is PG&E beyond now an in-state fix? Do we need to go outside of the state to fix it?
Well, what I said is I'm hoping to get as many bidders as possible. When asked, does that include one of the individuals that is in the utility business? The answer is yes. I want as many people bidding, including cities and municipalities. We have been very clear. Cities like San Francisco, San Jose, up in Northern California are looking to purchase assets. We've actually been working with those cities. So this is not exclusive to one bidder or another. But what I want is more competition than just one Wall Street hedge fund, which currently is the one most interested in their assets.
And one last thing while I have you here, I wanted to ask you about Katie Hill's resignation. Will you call for a special election to fill the seat in District 25?
Yeah, we'll wait for the formal resignation, and then we'll figure out the appropriate time to do that in a way that does two things. It protects the taxpayers in terms of costs associated with the election, and also tries to anticipate a frame that recognizes we've got that early March primary coming as well. So the answer is yes. We just have to figure out the exact time.
All right. That's California Governor Gavin Newsom. Thank you very much, Governor.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up amidst all the news when it comes to fires, Hollywood lost a legendary icon over the weekend. He didn't have an acting career, but you definitely know the movies he had his hand in. We're going to tell you all about the life and career of Robert Evans coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Hollywood lost a legend over the weekend. Film producer Robert Evans died Saturday. He was 89. Evans had a brief acting career, but in 1962, he became a movie producer using some of the money he had built up selling women's apparel in the 50s. Now, it would be an understatement to say that things started to move really fast for Evans. Just 5 years later, he became the head of production at struggling Paramount Pictures and turned things around quickly for the studio, overseeing major hits, including Rosemary's Baby and The Godfather.
What have you done to it? What have you done to its eyes?
He has his father's eyes.
What are you talking about? Guy's eyes are normal. What have you done to him, you maniac?
You look terrible. Once it eats. I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
It's too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Now, if that wasn't enough, Evans then made a deal with Paramount, which allowed him to stay on as the boss there, but also independently produce movies on his own. And he did, again, with classic hits such as Marathon Man and Chinatown.
Is it safe?
You're talking to me?
Is it safe?
It's what safe?
Is it safe?
I don't know what you mean.
Take him home! Just get him the hell out of here!
Go home, Jake. I'm doing you a favor.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Now, the 80s were not kind to Robert Evans. He just wasn't able to recreate his past successes with the movies he put out. He was also part of a drug scandal linked to a murder case. But in the 90s, he reinvented himself with his best-selling autobiography, The Kid Stays in the Picture. And this led him to voicing his title character in the 2003 Comedy Central cartoon series Kid Notorious, inspired by his career and life in Hollywood. Joining me now is the director of that series, Pete Michaels. Pete, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Now, you met Evans in his later years. What was he like to work with? I mean, this is a legend we're talking about.
Yeah, he was quite a character, even in his later years. I mean, when I first was contacted by the producers to interview for the show, I really didn't know who he was. I mean, I'd seen all the movies, and I'd heard about the book and heard about the documentary based on the book, The Kid Stays in the Picture. But when I first Googled him, I got member of parliament, I got a comedian, I'm like, and I got movie producer. I'm like, well, it's an animated series, it must be about the comedian. And I was surprised it was actually about Robert Evans, movie producer. But once you get into the whole Robert Evans, is almost a whole mythos about, you know, his persona.
Yeah,
it was quite fascinating, and it was just amazing to be working with the guy who created all those movies.
Any moments working with Robert Evans that stick out to you? I mean, he was so larger than life and so flamboyant. I'm just wondering if there's anything that you remember the most.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just even working with him, it was not the usual animated production by any means. It was, he would come into the studio. He would be very much hands-on, even though his reputation preceded him. So we knew that, you know, he liked conflict, and view conflict makes great art. And we had known that, like, you know, all the stories about he got kicked off the set and Coppola feuded with him, and sort of like, oh, this is going to be really difficult. But it was very much, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was very unpredictable at times, and we would go to review designs and review storyboards with him at his house, and it was just amazing, fascinating to be there, just at his house, Woodland, which had so much history to it. We would go down and look at designs. He even invited the crew. He was very hands-on, but he was also very much, he wanted to be your friend. He didn't want to just be, he wanted to work with you as a friend and not just as an artist. But he would invite the whole crew to his house, to his screening room in his backyard to watch Harold and Maude. And everybody went to go down and watch his movies with him in the places where the filmmakers actually screened the dailies, and it was just a fascinating, fascinating adventure for everybody.
Really quick, P, I got just a few seconds left. I played some clips of some of the movies he was involved with, Rosemary's Baby, The Godfather, Marathon Man, Chinatown. What would you say, Pete, is his legacy in cinema? How will he be best remembered?
Oh, by doing the movies that were unique in their special voice and storytelling as well, and giving directors and artists a special voice and letting them be that voice. And he was very encouraging to do that. And one story I'd like to just quickly share.
Quickly, as fast as you can.
Yeah, if you ever watch the Kid Notorious series, in the opening credits is a shot of Bob walking on a sea of women's butts, and that was all Bob. He insisted on that. Like, I want to be walking on a sea of butts. That's what I want to do. So he's very much involved in his brand and getting that out there. And
that's animation director Pete Michaels, remembering film legend Robert Evans. Pete, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. We will be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.